HD Smartcast. You're listening to a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hi, this is Manjula Narayan, National Books Editor, Hindustan Times, and this is the Books and Authors Podcast. It's a weekly podcast where I speak to authors who've got a new book out. Hey, welcome to this edition of Books and Authors, and today I have with me Janaki Lenin, author of Every Creature Has a Story, What Science Reveals About Animal Behavior. Hi, Janaki.
Hi, Manjula. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I was reading your book and it's wonderful. I love it.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Thank you.
It's so full of detail and anyway, it's about animals. So, I mean, I love animals, so maybe not humpback whales, but you know, and the fact that you've written about them and in such a, it's like complicated things, but you've broken it down and made it simple for somebody, a lay person like me. I mean, I know nothing about, complicated biological things, you know. And I assume a lot of people are like that. So, but you've taken things about the animal kingdom, about animal behavior, and you've put it out there and also presented it in such a way that humans can see that they're not that different from animals after all. You know?
Yeah, that's the point of it. Yeah, you've nailed it.
Okay, but I think in the preface you said that it started off as a column for The Wire, right?
That's right, yeah.
So how did it grow out of that? And I mean, this is, you said that you've added information to it, and I don't know how you pulled off a weekly column on, you know, fairly complicated things. How did you do it?
Well, I would start on a Monday morning, trolling through all the press releases that I had squirreled away as interesting to be checked out. What on earth is going on here, sort of. And then I would pick the one story that really grabbed me and then read the scientific paper, figure out why it was earth-shattering, speak to the researchers. And the column typically went out on a Friday or Saturday. So I had a week to write the story, essentially.
Looking at the amount of detail in each of the essays, you know, I mean, even speaking to a researcher, to get the right researcher who works on a specific area that you're interested in, I mean, I can imagine that that's a huge task, you know.
Well, it's actually simple. There's something called Google Scholar, which is for science. And it's essentially a search engine for scientific papers. So if I wanted to look at, say, hearing abilities of humpback whales, I just go and look it up there and see what scientists have written over the last 1 year or 5 years, or I can set the custom range. It's just like doing a Google search. So without Google Scholar, I wouldn't have been able to do this column. So yeah, different age, I would have been sitting in some musty old library and pulling filing cabinets out.
You mentioned in the preface that you added to these original articles. So let's talk about that as well.
So the first, I think I started the column in 2015. And when I started putting together the essays for the book, it was 2018. So in the intervening 3 years, I looked to see if researchers had added to what had I had last reported in 2015, for example. And if they had, then I updated the article to reflect what we know now. So basically, it's not just what was published in The Wire, but it's like upgraded as science has found out more. I wasn't able to do it in every single case, but in a lot of cases, there were many more things that scientists had found out to add to that original story. So I made it much more current.
Okay. So I love chimpanzees in mourning. then the amorous octopus, and feigning dead to avoid sex was really very funny.
Well, you heard of the headache. How about taking it one step further? Pretend you're dead.
Just dropping down from the sky and pretending you're dead like you're a corpse. I would never have thought dragonflies had this sort of devious side to them.
Well, next time you look at dragonflies, you've got to wonder, right?
Even while I was reading it, I kept thinking, have I seen dragonflies just lying on the floor? Were they pretending? It's quite possible that they were. Okay. And even the humpback whales ones, whales essay was very good. You've taken, I don't know, qualities that humans assume are, exclusive to us, like altruism or, voting and, agreement within groups and mourning. And you've kind of like spoken about animals doing those things, right?
Yeah.
So talk about that.
So this is a thread that's sort of run through the previous two books I've written called My Husband and Other Animals, part one and part two. So I mean, people really objected to that title because, how dare I call my husband an animal, and people giving me lectures on how I should, quote unquote, worship him. And
it's such a tangent.
So I didn't start out with that thought, but it was just people, readers' reaction to that title that got me thinking how we set ourselves apart from animals, how we think we're superior to them, how, we are capable of all these great things. And we are constantly trying to make that difference as wide as possible. And here are all these animals doing all these cool things forever, and we're just discovering them, and they're constantly showing us that they are fully capable of doing what we are capable of doing, that they have a complex inner life of ability to find solutions to complex issues, which might also be a problem in another way. So they find solution to that. It's this constant, trying to diversify, adapt, and exploit situations to their benefit. That just totally amazed me.
Yeah, the voting among wild dogs in Africa is like, I don't know, African wild dogs, that was quite amazing. I mean, I never thought... one thinks about dogs having empathy. Yeah, you know that because you live with dogs. But this voting thing is quite,
Yeah, we vote our leaders into power, whereas the wild dogs have an alpha male and female. So they vote on what to do. Do we laze and just dream, or do we go out and do some hard work and bring down a gazelle?
Yeah, so it sounds like a good life. And you also ask questions that, one wouldn't have thought about at all. Like, why don't elephants get cancer?
So when you are a giant creature, your cells are multiplying at an exponential rate. And when they are multiplying, they don't copy the DNA part very faithfully. There are errors start creeping in. And when that happens, you have a tendency to develop tumors which can become malignant and cause cancer. That's one form of cancer that can be related to body size, body mass, essentially. So an elephant is so huge, and it grows from this tiny little creature. So it, the degree of exponential replication of those cells is astonishing compared to, say, humans. So the number of errors that can creep in also has to be numerous, but somehow they're not getting tumors, and they're not getting cancer, and they're not dying of cancer. And that has perplexed people a lot. At the same time, the if you are really small, you also have a propensity to be short-lived. And elephants are long-lived. So the longer you live, the bigger body mass you have, the greater your risk of getting cancer. And so they looked at the genome of the elephant and found this particular element that it has many copies of. We have only two. And if we are born with only one copy, we get a form of hereditary cancer. And elephants have like 20 copies of it.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Which is what helps them. They think this is what helps them kick cancer. So the doctors are looking at how to use that to treat people with this form of hereditary cancer. Usually it affects children because it's congenital. They're born with it. So there's a lot of pediatric cancer in that. That syndrome affects children a lot. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to figure out how to help children with that form of cancer.
Okay. So when you're talking about genetics, it's also another thing that I was wondering when I was reading, you know, when I was reading the book, and especially the essay on monogamy among rodents, voles, I think. And, you know, and you talk about how some vasopressin receptors and the DNA sequencing is what makes them monogamous, right? Or in the ones which are.
So they have these receptors in the brain, and if they have this particular, the number of receptors in the brain in a particular area, that's to do with geography, like their ability to tell where they are. So it's kind of funny. So the ones that tend to lose their way, who don't know where their home range is, who are blundering into everyone else's territory, they are the ones that are promiscuous. The ones that know where they are and who stick to their, you know, territory tend to be monogamous. And that, I don't know if I mentioned it. So we have this thing about whether men or women have a better sense of direction. And so I have this thing with my husband when we're driving somewhere to a new place and we're trying to find directions. And, you know, we always have this argument, oh, you don't have any sense of direction. We're supposed to go this way. So I was chuckling in my head when I read that about our ties to monogamy and promiscuity.
And it's exactly, you know, I also thought that if this is the case, you know, in some distant future date, you know, maybe some devious person can decide that, you know, that they will like mess with genetics and somehow get their partner to be absolutely exclusive. It's possible.
They did that, no, with the voles. They injected them with this thing. I don't remember.
Among humans, you know, if you're going to extrapolate from voles.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's possible, I'm sure. But I don't know if it's going to pass all the ethics committee.
So that's Janaki Lenin telling me about her lovely new book, Every Creature Has a Story. Join us in part two for more on monogamous voles, altruistic whales, voting dogs, crazy kias, and more fantastic beasts.
This was a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.